Welcome back, Ninja Nerds, to another episode of the Ninja Nerd Podcast. We're excited. We got another good one for you today. It's on antihypertensive medications. So get ready for it. It's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get started, like always, ninjanerd.org, subscribe, grab your notes, grab your illustrations, and let's get ready to learn. Zach?
Yeah, there is a lot to talk about with antihypertensive medications.
There's no time to waste.
Right? No, not a second. So we gotta really kind of chuck through a lot of these. I'm really trying to break it down in a way that I think really helps you guys to first kind of understand the different mechanisms of hypertension, then talking about how these drugs work, and then what are the best indications and some adverse reactions to talk about throughout the process.
That's awesome. So let's start off first, Zach. Talk to our listeners a little bit about the definition of hypertension. What are our ranges here?
Yeah, so there is different goals out there. We're not going to go through them intensely. I just want you guys to understand that there is like the ACC, AHA goals out there that talk about their particular blood pressure measurements and what determines a patient to be kind of like stage one, stage two, etc. I think it's just important to kind of understand that generally a patient with like stage two hypertension is usually greater than 140 over 90. So that's greater 140 systolic over 90 diastolic. I think the other thing is also really important to understand is that patients who maybe have like a underlying hypertension that don't get treatment, or for whatever particular reason, their, you know, hypertension continues to progress and they start to have really, really high blood pressure where it starts actually kind of cranking up about greater than 180 over 120. So it's greater than 180 systolic over 120 diastolic. What happens with that is that you start having an increased risk potentially of target organ damage. So there is this term called hypertensive urgency and hypertensive emergency that I actually think is worth remembering, especially since these are the ones that we want to really get on top of and know which type of antihypertensive medications to use. So whenever a patient has a blood pressure greater than 180 over 120 and they do not have any target organ damage, then it's important to remember that that's a hypertensive urgency. And that's not something that you actually need to start IV antihypertensive medications for right away. But the patient who does have a blood pressure of greater than 180 over 120 with target organ damage, that's a patient who's in a hypertensive emergency, and you really need to start working to get their blood pressure down pretty quickly and actually, you know, help them to prevent any further damage. So I think that's really important to understand that.
So what is target organ damage? If someone has hypertension and it's at that range, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the number alone really means nothing when you think about it. I think what's really important is understanding this, the target organ damage. So I think first thing to think about is the central nervous system. Whenever the blood pressure is just extremely high, it increases the risk of actually causing vasogenic edema in the posterior portions of the brain. And that can increase the risk of what's called posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, which can cause obviously encephalopathy, and it also can cause seizures. So that's a really, really big thing to watch out for. The other thing is that when the blood pressure is really, really high, you can like pop and rupture some of those blood vessels in the brain and cause things like an ICH or an intracerebral hemorrhage, subarachnoid hemorrhage. So definitely watch out for those things. The eyes, if you have the time and the ability, go ahead, find that ophthalmoscope if you can find it somewhere within the hospital, and go ahead and look at the eyes and see if you can see any kind of like, you know, blunting or kind of like loss of the complete margins of the optic disc and a lot of swelling there due to high intracranial pressure. The other thing is the heart. I would actually consider looking at an EKG, making sure that they don't have any kind of like ST segment elevation, ST segment depression. And then if they do have any ST segment changes that are above their baseline, then I would go ahead and get a troponin and look to see if there's any elevation there as well. Because that's another thing, that high pressure puts a lot of strain on the heart. The other thing is that when your blood pressure is super, super high, it has the ability to rip right through the tunica interna. And if it does, then it starts dissecting through the tunica interna and tunica media, you can end up with an aortic dissection. So that's another potential complication. The other thing is that pulmonary. So this one's really interesting. So whenever your blood pressure is so dang high, imagine that the pressure within your aorta is like 200 or something of that nature. That means your left ventricle is going to have to generate a super high pressure to push blood out of the left ventricle and into the aorta. And so because of that, whenever the blood pressure is extremely high, it actually reduces the ability of blood to get out of the heart. So it reduces like the stroke volume, the cardiac output. And so because of that, blood backs up into the actual left atrium and into the pulmonary circulation and cause massive pulmonary edema. And so that's another particular thing to watch out for, especially this thing. It's called SCAPE, sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema, or flash pulmonary edema. You can definitely see that with really, really high blood pressure, especially in CHF patients. The last one I would also remember is that whenever your blood pressure is super, super high, you're putting a lot of strain on that glomeruli. You're just busting open the glomeruli like it's no one's business. And because of that, you can have a lot of hematuria, a lot of acute kidney injury as a result of that. So watch out for a bump in their creat and again, a drop in their GFR.
So before we get too really detailed into all of these medications and everything else we have to talk about, let's try and maybe lay some foundation, Zach, on the mechanism of hypertension and then a little bit on the mechanism of the antihypertensive medications that we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely. So I think one of the big things is that whenever we have a patient who is hypertensive, right, you need to understand the basic kind of like pathophysiology behind it. So obviously with hypertension, I think it's important to remember that it's a measure of blood pressure, right? So it's elevated blood pressure. So you need to know the formula for blood pressure, that blood pressure is equal to cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance. And so if I think about that formula, that I can say that really any increase in cardiac output will cause an increase in blood pressure, right? And then any increase in systemic vascular resistance will also increase my blood pressure, right? So because of that, I need to think about, what is cardiac output? Well, cardiac output is really dependent upon heart rate and stroke volume. So if a patient has an increase in heart rate, their heart is beating really fast, there's a theoretical thing that they could increase their cardiac output and increase their blood pressure. On top of that, stroke volume is dependent primarily on two, I want to talk about two primary ones here, which is going to be your preload and your contractility. So whenever a patient has a really, really intense contractility of their heart, that's also going to increase their stroke volume, increase their cardiac output, push more blood out of the heart, and increase their blood pressure. So far we have increased heart rate will increase your cardiac output, increase your BP. Increased contractility will increase your cardiac output and increase your BP. The other thing here is that if you have a lot of preload, so you have a lot of venous return, a lot of blood coming back to the heart, that's going to increase their stroke volume, and that's going to significantly increase their cardiac output and increase their blood pressure. So that's another one. So we have increased heart rate, increased contractility, and increased preload. All of these things can increase your cardiac output and your blood pressure. Well, what about the systemic vascular resistance? That's another one, right? So that's basically the tone of your arteries and to some degree your veins, but the potentially more predominantly is the arteries. So if they're squeezed down really, really hard, what's that going to do to the resistance of blood flow? It's going to increase it. And if you increase resistance, you significantly increase blood pressure. So that's another thing. So there's, I think, a big kind of concept here is that there's four primary mechanisms by which patients can really have a jump in their BP. And this is an increase in heart rate, an increase in contractility, an increase in preload, and an increase in systemic vascular resistance. And the reason why I categorize it like this is because I think it works out really well to talk about which drugs decrease heart rate and contractility, which drugs decrease systemic vascular resistance, which drugs actually decrease your preload. And I think if we think about it like that, it's easier to remember these drugs. So let's actually start going through these particular agents. So the first category that I want to think about is those drugs that decrease heart rate and contractility. And I like to combine these two together because they're just so associated, like they're so nice and intertwined together. So the first category, there's three drugs that actually decrease heart rate and contractility. The first one is your centrally acting drugs. In other words, they actually suppress the central drive of norepinephrine release on the heart and the blood vessels. And so because of that, they would actually reduce your heart rate and your contractility. This would be things like clonidine and alpha-methyldopa. Another thing is you can actually directly block the epinephrine and norepinephrine at the beta 1 receptors in the heart. And this would be drugs like your atenolol, acebutolol, bisoprolol, metoprolol, esmolol, a lot of these drugs out there. And then the last one is there's calcium channels that are present on the actual muscle of the heart as well as on the nodal cells of the heart. And so because of that, if you actually block those calcium channels, you block calcium entry into the nodal cells, that reduces their heart rate or the conduction, and you also reduce their ability to contract. And so this would be drugs like verapamil and diltiazem. So those are the three drugs that I want you to remember for decreasing heart rate and contractility: the centrally acting, the beta 1 blockers, and then your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Really, really important to remember that one. The ones that work on the heart is non-dihydropyridine, verapamil and diltiazem. All right, the next category is the ones that actually kind of decrease your systemic vascular resistance. In other words, they relax those arteries. If they relax the arteries, they're going to directly drop your blood pressure. Like the one prior, they decreased your heart rate and decreased your contractility. That's going to reduce your cardiac output and then your blood pressure. This, if you relax the vessels, you'll relax and actually decrease their blood pressure. So what are the drugs in this category? It's actually a long list. So the first one is centrally acting. So that's their clonidine and alpha-methyldopa. Believe it or not, they actually suppress norepinephrine release, again, from the central nervous system. And then because of that, you have less sympathetic tone going to not just your heart, but you have less sympathetic tone going to your arteries. And so those are actually going to be relaxing as well. On top of that, on your arteries, you have a bunch of different types of receptors or channels. And so one of those receptors that are present on the actual smooth muscle of the arteries are called alpha-1 receptors. And if you have drugs that can actually block the alpha-1 receptors, guess what? You'll relax them and then drop the pressure. And so that could be things like your alpha-1 selective blockers. So this is your doxazosin, terazosin, prazosin, all of those, tamsulosin, those kinds of drugs. But then you have the other ones that are not just pure alpha 1, they have a little bit of alpha 2 as well. So they're both alpha 1 and alpha 2 kind of blockers. This is phentolamine and phenoxybenzamine. All right. The next thing is we can have another drug category that actually loves the alpha receptors, but guess what else it loves to bind to? The beta receptors. So you're like, what the heck? I thought we just talked about the beta ones that actually are there. Potentially the atenolol, isobutylol, metoprolol, esomeprazole, all those ones. Yes, but there's a class of beta blockers that are actually beta and alpha blockers. This is labetalol and carvedilol. So believe it or not, what these drugs can actually do is labetalol and carvedilol could drop your heart rate, drop your contractility, and vasodilate to reduce your blood pressure. So they can reduce both cardiac output and they can reduce your systemic vascular resistance, which is pretty cool. So this is labetalol and carvedilol. The next thing is we have calcium channels that are present on the vascular smooth muscle, but this is not the non-dihydropyridine. This is the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. So this is things like amlodipine, nifedipine, nicardipine, isradipine, a lot of these really, really good drugs out there, very commonly utilized ones. The next thing is we have potential mechanisms inside of the cell. So there's a molecule here inside of our cell called cyclic GMP. And cyclic GMP is a really interesting molecule that actually regulates our myofilaments. And so it controls the contraction and relaxation of them. We have particular drugs that can actually work to increase cyclic GMP. And if you increase cyclic GMP, what it does is it actually inhibits the myofilaments from actually undergoing contraction. The reason it does that, it modulates something called the myosin light chain phosphatase. I think it's a little bit beyond the scope of this, but you get the point is that they work to increase cyclic GMP inside of the smooth muscle, and that helps to actually inhibit muscle contraction, and that will allow for the smooth muscle to relax and the blood vessel to dilate. These drugs are things like hydralazine, nitroprusside, and here's a really, really important thing because sometimes this can be misleading. Nitroglycerin. But nitroglycerin, it is an arterial vasodilator, but it's usually at very high doses. Like I'm talking pretty high doses for it to actually be a true arterial vasodilator. It's primarily a venodilator, but at high doses, that puppy can have some really, really good arterial vasodilation. All right, so that's the direct acting ones. Again, they work to increase cyclic GMP. Hydralazine does that directly, but the nitroglycerin and nitroprusside, they work through a weird mechanism where they help to increase nitric oxide release from the endothelial cells. And then the nitric oxide, when it gets into the smooth muscle cells, that activates cyclic GMP. And then cyclic GMP inhibits the muscle cells from contracting. And then therefore the blood vessel will actually relax and then start to dilate. So those are those direct acting drugs. The next ones that decrease systemic vascular resistance are really cool. These are your renin, angiotensin, aldosterone system inhibitors. So if you guys remember, our kidneys make a molecule called renin. Renin actually converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1, and angiotensinogen is made by the liver. Angiotensin 1 then is actually converted into angiotensin 2 by the angiotensin converting enzyme in the lungs. And then angiotensin 2 can exert a lot of effects. One of those effects is that it can really act on the arteries and squeeze the living heck out of them. And when it squeezes them, it really increases your resistance and increases your blood pressure. So what if I gave drugs that actually could inhibit the actual angiotensin 2 from acting on the blood vessels, or I gave drugs that actually inhibited the formation of angiotensin 2. Either way, it's the same result, right? So I could give a drug that actually inhibits ACE, which will prevent angiotensin 2 formation. That's called ACE inhibitors. So captopril, enalapril, lisinopril, benzopril, they're great drugs, very commonly utilized ones. And then I can also block angiotensin 2 right at the receptors on the blood vessel. And those are called your angiotensin receptor blockers, or your ARBs. And that's your Lazartan, Candazartan, Valsartan. All right, so those are those drugs that are, again, working to decrease systemic vascular resistance. The last category that we can utilize these drugs or drug categories for is you're going to give drugs that can decrease preload. Now, this is a really important thing. Preload is dependent upon blood volume, but it's also dependent upon venous tone. All right. So what do I mean by venous tone? So venous tone is basically the squeeze on the veins, right? So if I, for example, if I have a lot of squeeze of the veins, so I'm actually squeezing them on, and I'm going to push a lot of blood back up into the right heart. That's going to increase the preload of the venous return to the right heart. That'll increase cardiac output and increase BP. So that's a thing that I need to think about. So if I give drugs that actually work potentially to dilate the veins, they're going to reduce the venous tone. That's going to reduce the amount of blood going to the right heart, reducing the preload, reducing the stroke volume and the cardiac output. That'll reduce the blood pressure. So that's one mechanism, is reducing venous tone can actually reduce preload. The other thing is, if I have less volume in the veins, I'm not going to have as much volume to return to the right side of the heart. So if I have a patient who's super volume overloaded, they're going to have a lot of volume in their vessels, a lot of return of blood to their heart, a lot of preload, a lot of stroke volume, a lot of cardiac output, and increase their BP. If I give drugs to actually reduce the blood volume, I can reduce the venous return, reduce the stroke volume, and reduce the cardiac output, and reduce the BP. What are the drugs that work in this category? So let's actually break it down into drugs that actually reduce venous tone. That's the centrally acting clonidine alpha methyldopa. They work on the alpha 1 receptor. So if you have less norepinephrine being released from the central nervous system, that means less of it's acting on the alpha 1 receptors on the arteries and the veins. That means they're not going to squeeze. They're not going to push blood up into the right heart. The next one is alpha blockers themselves. So this includes your alpha blockers, specifically the ones that are direct alpha 1. So terazosin, prazosin, doxazosin, and then tamsulosin, as well as the alpha 1 and alpha 2, because they both, again, block alpha 1 receptors. So phentolamine and phenoxybenzamine. And then lastly, don't forget about labetalol and carvedilol, because they also have alpha blockade in addition to their beta blockade as well. The next thing is the direct acting ones. So these ones are actually going to be working very interestingly to increase nitric oxide release from the endothelial cells. And because they work to increase nitric oxide release from the endothelial cells, that activates cyclic GMP and the venous smooth muscle, that actually works to inhibit muscle contraction in the venous smooth muscle, and that reduces the venous tone, and you don't get as much blood going back to the right heart. What are those drugs? This is isosorbidinitrate and low-dose nitroglycerin. Remember I told you high-dose nitroglycerin dilates arteries. Low-dose nitroglycerin dilates veins. Okay, important to remember. The next category is your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system inhibitors. You're probably like, wait, Zach, you said that reduced SVR. Well, didn't you notice that clonidine did everything pretty much at this point? You would think it's a great drug. It happens to be the clonidine.
I was just going to say that. I'm like, this drug is just constantly coming up again and again.
Yeah, and then to be honest with you, we don't really use it. It's kind of like a third line drug in the actual grand scheme of things, which is really interesting. But I think renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system inhibitors is really cool, because you see that they reduce systemic vascular resistance and they reduce preload. How do they do that? It's pretty straightforward. When you release renin from the kidneys, it activates it forms angiotensin 1 eventually, and then angiotensin 2, and then angiotensin 2 works to do what? Stimulates aldosterone and ADH. Aldosterone and ADH do what? They work in the kidney to reabsorb more sodium and water. If you resorb more sodium and water from the kidney into the bloodstream, what happens to your blood volume? It goes up. What did I tell you happens if you increase blood volume? You're going to increase the amount of blood to return to the right heart, and therefore you're going to increase preload, increase stroke volume, cardiac output, and BP. So you get the point. If I give a drug that basically shuts down at each point of the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, I could do it. So if I give an ACE inhibitor, I'll inhibit angiotensin 2, which won't actually activate aldosterone or ADH. If I give an angiotensin receptor blocker, I'll block angiotensin 2 from stimulating aldosterone and ADH. And if I give an aldosterone antagonist, I block aldosterone from being able to reabsorb sodium and water across the kidneys. Too bad there isn't an ADH kind of inhibitor in this situation, but you see the point. So that's where these drugs are really good, at reducing the blood volume and reducing the SVR. The last category that will reduce your blood volume, that again helps to reduce preload, is your diuretics. So you're helping to pee out sodium and water. It's not that hard to imagine, right? So thiazide diuretics are really good at getting rid of a lot of sodium retention, getting rid of a lot of water. So you get rid of sodium, you get rid of water, you reduce your blood volume, you reduce your preload, cardiac output, and blood pressure. So these are your thiazide diuretics. So things like hydrochlorothiazide, chlorothiazide, chlorthalidone, metolazone. There is theoretical evidence. There is actually theoretical prospect of things out there that think that thiazide diuretics may actually have a very mild vasodilatory effect, so they can reduce SBR, but there's not actual true documented evidence. It's more theoretical out there. But again, I would just stick with it reducing preload. So that's your thiazide diuretics. Hydrochlorothiazide, chlorthalidone, chlorothiazide, metolazone are going to be the big ones. The last one is a loop diuretic. And a loop diuretic is going to be things like furosemide, bumetanide, torsemide. These pull a lot of volume, a lot of dilute urine, some sodium and chloride out into the urine as well. And so if you get rid of a lot of fluid inside of your body, you reduce that blood volume, you're going to reduce preload, cardiac output, and blood pressure as well. So these are also drugs that we can utilize. So I hope that really categorizing these drugs in that type of way, at drugs that decrease heart rate and contractility, drugs that decrease systemic vascular resistance, drugs that decrease preload will help you to organize these in your head so you can think about their mechanism of action and how they work in treating hypertension.
Zach, real quick, I think going back to your renin-angiotensin aldosterone system inhibitors, what were some of the examples of aldosterone antagonists?
I think you missed that one. Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah. So we already talked about ACE inhibitors and ARBs, but the aldosterone antagonists, don't forget things like eplerenone, spironolactone, and amiloride are also really good drugs out there.
Great. All right, let's go ahead and transition now into the next part of our podcast here. And we're going to be talking about the indications and the adverse drug reactions of particular antihypertensive agents.
Yeah, so I think when we talk about these, we're going to kind of break them down into, you know, particular categories. So first one is your centrally acting antihypertensive. So this is your clonidine, your alpha-methyldopa. Now, clonidine is a pretty decent agent, but it's not really going to be one of those first-line agents. And you would think that seems odd because it hits so many different mechanisms. It reduced heart rate, it reduced contractility, it reduced systemic vascular resistance, it reduced preload. However, it's just not one of those first-line agents. It could be used in situations, particularly, I'd say, hypertensive crises related to patients who are withdrawing. So when a patient withdraws from things like benzodiazepines or opioids or alcohol, they tend to have, during that withdrawal period, a massive sympathetic surge where they release massive amounts of norepinephrine. They become tachycardic, tachypneic, they become hypertensive, and they also become kind of delirious. And so in those situations, I think clonidine is a particular, like, you know, decent agent in being able to help with mitigating those withdrawal symptoms, because again, it blunts the tachycardia, blunts the hypertension, and also provides some sedative control as well. Only thing I would be careful of with this agent is that because it does have the ability to suppress like some of the reticular formation and the activity that plays a role in arousal, it can cause some degree of sedation, which may be beneficial in those patients who are withdrawing. The other one is alpha-methyldopa, not really a common agent that we utilize. One of the big things I think to remember for this one is that it has been shown to be safe in pregnancy. But one of the actual bad things or the downsides of this drug is that if you have a patient who's on alpha-methyldopa, watch that kind of hemoglobin hematocrit. There may be a slow drift in that. And then sometimes because of that, you may think, oh, they're becoming anemic for some reason, but you check what's called a Coombs test or a direct antibody kind of test, and it may show a positive Coombs test, like which may make you think about an autoimmune hemolytic anemia. The next category is your beta blockers. So we have the centrally acting, then we have our beta blockers. Now with the beta blockers, there's the beta 1 blockers. They're selective. So there's atenolol, acebutolol, bisoprolol, metoprolol, esmolol. They're really good at being able to reduce the heart rate. And I think that's one of the main things to think about these drugs. So because of that, I think beta blockers, yes, they can be decent at treating hypertension, but I would say that they can treat hypertension, especially if the patient has an associated tachycardia, like with their disease. So if a patient has atrial fibrillation or some type of chronic supraventricular tachycardia, like, you know, or atrial flutter, then a beta blocker like these categories may actually be beneficial, but they are not a first line agent in hypertension. So that's important to remember. They also can reduce contractility of the heart. And so that may be good in situations where you want to reduce the demand. So if you think about this in patients who have, you know, a lot of contractility where they're contracting and squeezing that heart so much, they're consuming tons of oxygen. And in situations where the supply is less or they want to reduce that demand, the amount of oxygen consumption, we can give beta blockers to reduce the contractility and reduce the demand that the actual heart is requiring for oxygen consumption. And that may be good in situations such as coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, post-myocardial infarction, and even hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. So again, not a first-line agent, but maybe something to add on to a first-line agent if a patient has associated atrial fibrillation, SVT, atrial flutter, as well as some disease that actually has where they have reduced O2 supply or they already have a high demand and you want to reduce that demand a little bit more. So in coronary artery disease, heart failure, post-MI, and hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. Kind of adverse effects to watch out for with these beta 1 blockers is because they can, you know, shut down the AV node. You want to watch out for any kind of overt bradycardia. Also, if patients have decompensated heart failure, I'd be really, really careful giving this drug. I have seen this once. It was actually pretty scary where a patient wasn't actually being compliant. They were given a big whopping dose of their metoprolol and they ended up becoming extremely bradycardic and extremely hypotensive and went into cardiogenic shock. So be careful with that. The other thing is that if a patient does have decompensated heart failure, so their cardiac output's already low, and you go ahead and give them a beta blocker, you're going to drop their cardiac output even more and put them into cardiogenic shock. So watch out for that. The other thing is that when a patient becomes hypoglycemic, right, if they have diabetes, what can happen is when you become hypoglycemic, which is really interesting, is that your body develops a sympathetic response to the hypoglycemia. It makes you tachycardic, makes you diaphoretic, etc. When you block that effect, then you lose the ability to become aware of your hypoglycemic symptoms. So you can cause hypoglycemia unawareness as well. The next category is non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. So this is going to be things like verapamil, diltiazem, and these specifically work on the calcium channel blockers in the heart, the myocardium. That's it. So because of that, they reduce heart rate on the nodal cell, so they're great in AFib, SVT. They also reduce contractility, so it's good in being able to reduce the demand in diseases that already have a high demand or have a reduced oxygen supply to, you know, help to level off that mismatch. So coronary artery disease, heart failure, and hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy are beneficial. Just like beta blockers, they slow down the AV node, so they can cause bradycardia. And on top of that, you also want to be careful if a patient already has decompensated heart failure or heart failure in general, and you give them a calcium channel blocker, you could drop their cardiac output, make them hypotensive, and put them into shock. So watch out for that as well. The next category is your alpha blocker. So alpha blockers, there's going to be the alpha 1 receptors that are present on the arteries and also on the veins. There's three categories of alpha blockers that I want you to remember. There's selective alpha 1 blockers. There's non-selective, so alpha 1 and alpha 2 blockers. And then there's the last category, which is an alpha and beta blocker. So it's a mixed blocker. And so in this situation here, alpha 1 blockers primarily are going to be used to treat hypertension in patients who have an associated BPH, so benign prostatic hyperplasia. And the reason why is there's alpha 1 receptors on the internal urethrosphincter, which helps to be able to mitigate your urine production. And so when you give these drugs, you actually work to block the internal urethrosphincter, relax it a little bit, and allow for urine to come out, but also dilate the arterioles and dilate the veins. So you drop systemic vascular resistance and drop preload. With the alpha 1 and 2 antagonists, they're also very strong alpha blockers. This is phentolamine and phenoxybenzamine. These are actually really only potentially in the textbooks beneficial in patients who have pheochromocytomas, tumors of the adrenal medulla that are pumping out epinephrine and norepinephrine, as well as in hypertensive crises due to monoamine oxidase inhibitors, where they're blasting out norepinephrine and they're hitting those alpha 1 receptors. And so you can help to be able to blunt that effect of norepinephrine and epinephrine on the alpha 1 receptors and reduce that kind of hypertensive crisis. The things I would actually be careful for and watch out for with these drugs is that because they dilate the veins, they can cause orthostasis, and because they reduce your systemic vascular resistance, they do have the ability to cause a reflex tachycardia, so watch out for that. The next category of the alpha blockers, the alpha and beta blockers. That's the one where it's a mixed. And so this is labetalol and carvedilol. And so because they have the beta blockade, they do what the beta blockers do. They reduce heart rate. So they could be beneficial in AFib, SVT. They reduce contractility. So they may be beneficial in CAD, heart failure, post-MI. And here's the other really cool thing about this drug is that labetalol has been shown to be safe in pregnancy, just like alpha-methyldopa. The other thing I actually think is important to remember is labetalol is one of those drugs that's actually been shown to be pretty decent as an IV medication that you can give to patients who are in a hypertensive emergency. So that's basically when the blood pressure is greater than 180 over 120 and they also have associated target organ damage. All right, what about the adverse drug reactions of these? The alpha and beta blockers, they have the same thing. They're a combination of effects of both the alpha and the beta. So they can have the mild orthostasis, mild reflex. Actually, they don't have reflex tachycardia because why? Because they block the beta receptor. So they actually may cause bradycardia. They can actually kind of drop your blood pressure because they reduce your systemic vascular resistance, and also they reduce your contractility. So be careful of that in patients with decompensated heart failure. And again, they also have a little bit more of the beta 2 blockade. So it can actually cause, bronchospasm. So watch out for that one as well. And again, can blunt the sympathetic response to hypoglycemia called hypoglycemia unawareness. Okay, the next category here is the dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. So this is going to be like amlodipine, nifedipine, nicardipine. Ooh, I love that drug, nicardipine. It's such a good drug. But generally, these are interesting because they are going to be calcium channel blockers that block the calcium channels on the smooth muscle of blood vessels, whereas the non-dihydropyridine block the calcium channel on the myocardium of the heart. That's really important to remember. These are great drugs and happen to be first-line agents for anybody with like essential hypertension. So if me or Rob had hypertension, this would be a drug that I think could actually be one of the first line agents that we could be prescribed with. So it's a great, great drug, especially amlodipine or nifedipine. Nicardipine, on the other hand, is a little bit of a different story. I very commonly utilize this drug. It is a great drug in patients who have hypertensive emergencies because it's a very decently kind of quasi-titratable agent that you can utilize in hypertensive emergencies. The other thing that actually is important to remember is nifedipine. Nifedipine is one of those calcium channel blockers that has been shown to be have a good safety profile in patients who are pregnant as well. So consider that. Now, because they reduce the systemic vascular resistance, you do want to watch out for reflex tachycardia, and they have a very mild reduction in the venous tone. So because of that, they may have a little bit of orthostasis as well. The next drug category is your direct acting. So these are those interesting ones. So they're direct acting vasodilators. So this is your hydralazine. And then it's the combination hydralazine plus your nitrodilators. So that's nitroglycerin, nitroprusside. And there's even the other one, which is called isosorbidinitrate. But when you talk about direct acting vasodilators, let's talk first about hydralazine. So hydralazine is primarily an arterial dilator, but it does have a very, very mild venodilation. But since it's primarily an arterial dilator, it's going to reduce systemic vascular resistance. This is not your first line medication for hypertension. If often, it's really only used in patients who have heart failure. I think that as an outpatient kind of medication, it may be beneficial in patients who have heart failure, especially there has been literature and evidence that it actually may be more beneficial in African Americans, especially if they have heart failure, maybe a drug to add on to their regimen. The other thing is that it has been shown to be safe in pregnancy. So it has a good safety profile. So we have alpha methyldopa, we have nifedipine, and we also have hydralazine to add on to the safety profile for pregnancy. The only other thing that I would add for hydralazine is it may be a drug that can be utilized IV in patients with hypertensive emergencies. So if they have, again, greater than 180 over 120 with target organ damage, you may be able to give this as a bolus PRN to titrate towards a target blood pressure goal. I think any adverse drug reactions is, again, because it actually reduces your systemic vascular resistance. It'll drop your pressure and create a reflex tachycardia. It may have a mild venodilation, so it may have orthostasis. And this is usually something with very chronic use of the drug, so very chronic outpatient use. You may see a drug-induced lupus, which is kind of a little bit odd, but it's something that you may actually potentially see, especially on your exam, guys. All right, that's hydralazine. The next one is nitroglycerin. I happen to really, really like this drug. I think it's a really cool drug, and I think one of the big things is that it is an arterial dilator, but it's actually primarily a venodilator. Okay, so what it does, it increases nitric oxide, that activates cyclic GMP, that increases the activity of protein kinase G, which actually inhibits the enzymes that control the muscle contraction. And so if you inhibit muscle contraction, the muscles will actually relax. So it's a really cool drug. What I find, though, with this drug is that at low doses, it's a venodilator. And so that's not really going to be great for hypertension. It'd be more for reducing angina or patients who have like angina from coronary artery disease, or they're having an active MI. So any kind of acute coronary syndrome, really, or angina, like a stable angina, this actually may be a beneficial drug because it reduces the venous return, which reduces preload, reduces cardiac output, and that also reduces the work on the heart. Maybe a good drug in that situation. The real indication for hypertension is when it's at high doses. So when you give this drug at really, really high doses, I'm talking like 400, 800 mics, then you start seeing an actual arterial dilation. So it reduces systemic vascular resistance. And the real indication of why we would use it if a patient has acute heart failure with what's called a sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema, also sometimes referred to as flash pulmonary edema. So this is basically when a patient's afterload is so dang high, they can't get any blood out of that poor left ventricle and the blood just backflows into the left atrium, into the pulmonary circulation, and just causes massive pulmonary edema. And so this drug will really, really reduce your systemic vascular resistance, which will reduce your afterload and help to be able to pump a ton of blood out of that left ventricle. Plus, if you also think about it, it venodilates. So if you get venodilation, you reduce the preload to the right side of the heart, and you reduce the amount of blood going from the right side to the actual left side, and that again reduces the amount of blood that could leak out of the pulmonary capillaries and worsen pulmonary edema. So you get kind of a double whammy with that drug. Big things I would watch out for is with this drug, if you don't watch closely, it can drop your pressure. And I think one of the big things is it can actually cause pretty profound hypotension, especially if a patient is taking it with a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. I would stay away from that. So if they're on Viagra or anything like that, do not give this drug. You can really drop their pressure pretty good. And the other thing I would actually watch out for is if they have a right ventricular myocardial infarction, those patients now can't pump any blood out of their right ventricle. If they had an MI and they knocked out their right ventricle, they can't pump blood out of their right ventricle. So their ability to get blood out of the heart, out of the right heart, is reduced. Now you take away any venous return to the right heart. Oh my gosh, no blood is going to get out of the right ventricle, and you'll put the patient in cardiogenic shock. So watch out for that. Next drug, I really try to stay away from this. I think this is like the vampire of antihypertensive agents. It's nitroprusside. So nitroprusside, again, just like nitroglycerin, increases nitric oxide release from the endothelial cells, activates cyclic GMP, which helps to be able to really inhibit those muscles from contracting. The big thing with this is that it's a super easily titratable agent. So the really only true indication of this drug is a patient with a hypertensive emergency. It used to be utilized very commonly in patients with aortic dissections, because again, it's really a good arterial dilator. The only downside to this drug and why I would kind of stay away from it is that, you know, some dose that is not been completely identified yet, it may actually cause cyanide toxicity. So I would kind of stay away from that. I think there's a lot of other drugs that could actually be more beneficial. And the other thing is it can actually cause a profound lactic acidosis as well. And so I just prefer to really kind of stay away from that drug. The next category of drugs are, I like to think about them as the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system inhibitors. So this is your ACE inhibitors, your ARBs, okay? With these drugs, you have your ACE inhibitors first, which are your captopril, enalapril, lisinopril. These are really, really good drugs. So along with amlodipine, which is one of those kind of like, you know, dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, that was a first line agent. ACE inhibitors, ARBs are also really good first line agents that I would also remember. Okay. Now, with these particular drugs, ACE inhibitors, so we have the prills, they're really good drugs. But one of the big things I think that's really important to remember these drugs is not only are they good as a first line agent, and I would actually kind of stay away from this drug in African Americans, just because patients with African American descent don't generally have a high renin type of hypertension. It's usually more of the Caucasian types of populations that have more of the benefit from ACE inhibitors and ARBs. So I think one of the big things is that with these kind of drugs, particularly ACE inhibitors, ARBs, they're decent in diabetes because they actually reduce proteinuria, and that's actually pretty beneficial. Plus in chronic kidney disease, they also lose a lot of albumin. That may be beneficial. One of the really cool things I think about this drug, and we'll talk about it, you know, maybe a little bit more whenever we get into more detail, but ACE inhibitors and ARBs, one of the really cool things about these drugs is that they reduce angiotensin II production, right? Or the action of angiotensin II. And so what's really cool about that is that angiotensin II acts on the efferent arterial and squeezes the living crap out of it. And so because of that, that increases the intraglomerular blood pressure. And so it pushes tons and tons of fluid and protein out into the actual glomerulus and causes you to cause further damage to the actual kidneys. And then thickening of the glomerular basement membrane, which progresses the disease. If you give an ACE inhibitor and ARB, you reduce angiotensin II on the efferent arterial. You reduce the intraglomerular blood pressure. You reduce the proteinuria and you reduce the glomerular basement membrane thickening, which reduces the severity of the CKD and the diabetic nephropathy. Pretty cool, right? So that's, I think it's a really good drug to actually think about in these patients. The other thing is there has been literature that basically when patients have an MI or they have heart failure, they have a reduced cardiac output after they have that event. And so because of that, they don't perfuse their kidneys very well. And so the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system goes haywire. And so because that renin angiotensin aldosterone system that increases your systemic vascular resistance, it increases your sodium and water retention, and all of those things increase your kind of ventricular hypertrophy and ventricular dilation. And that remodels the heart, where the heart then sucks and it gets worse. And it actually increases mortality in that sense. And so if we give drugs that inhibit the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, we could potentially reduce the cardiac remodeling and actually improve mortality. So these are great drugs in patients who have coronary artery disease, or they just had an MI, or they have heart failure. I really consider that as well. Things to think about with both of these, and I think it's really important. I'm talking about ACE inhibitors for ARBs. They both have the same indications. We can use either one of them. That's why they're so beautiful. I think the adverse effects is where you actually got to be careful. So they do have the ability, because they shut down aldosterone. Aldosterone, remember, what does it do? It actually reabsorbs sodium and excretes potassium. So you lose that ability. So because of that, potassium can build up in the blood. It has caused hyperkalemia, which increases your risk of arrhythmias, right? So watch out for that. The other thing is that they both can also, again, reduce the constriction of the efferent arteriole. That reduces the intraglomerular blood pressure, and that reduces your filtration. So that reduces your GFR. You don't clear creatinine as well. And so your creat can actually bump in these patients. So watch that as well. That's why I would be careful holding these drugs. I would actually hold them in a patient as an acute kidney injury. The last thing is that they both may actually work to kind of mediate this weird response where they can actually cause angioedema. The mechanism behind this is not completely understood, but it may work to cause some type of angioedema. So swelling of the lips, swelling of the tongue, swelling of the actual upper airway. So watch out for that. And the last thing is, more particularly with ACE inhibitors, they have the ability to kind of like inhibit the bradykinins kind of like a pathway. And so it can increase a lot of the bradykinins, preventing their from being metabolized. So bradykinins build up and they cause a lot of this dry cough within the lungs. And so that may be something to avoid in patients who have like a COPD or asthma, and instead use an ARB because they don't have that bradykinin induced cough. And it's really due to the ACE inhibitor. You're inhibiting the ACE enzyme, which not only converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, but it also helps to, you know, break down bradykinins. So watch out for that. The next drug category, man, is your direct acting again. So these are the other two that we have to talk about, the isosorbide dinitrate. And we already talked about this one before, the nitroglycerin, so we don't really need to think about this one. Isosorbide dinitrate, I really just want you to think about this with hydralazine. So isosorbide dinitrate, like hydralazine, dilates vessels. But here's the thing, hydralazine dilates the heck out of the arteries. The actual isosorbide dinitrate, it's a really potent venodilator. And so you're like, how is that going to help patients who have hypertension? It doesn't really help patients with hypertension. It's more of like a angina type of drug. But really, I think where it's actually most beneficial is in combination in patients who have very bad heart failure. And especially if those patients are African American. So remember I told you that heart failure with African American, patients who are African American who have heart failure really benefit from hydralazine. There's evidence against that. So in the same way, there's actually additional benefit if the patient has heart failure and African American, you can use hydralazine and isosorbide dinitrate. Let's weed this out. Why? Hydralazine dilates the artery, so that reduces the afterload, helps to get more blood out of the left heart. All right, that's good. We want blood out of the heart, okay? The other thing is isosorbide dinitrate reduces the preload. So you have less blood going into the right heart, less blood being pumped into the left heart. Again, that's reducing the amount of venous return. If the heart's really weak and it's not getting blood out, do you want to fill it with a ton of more blood? No, you want to reduce its filling so that you're not congesting the heart, thus the name congestive heart failure. So this may be really beneficial in a patient who has heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction, where you really want to be able to kind of reduce their afterload, get blood out of the heart, as well as reduce their preload so that you don't overload them. That would be a good combo for this drug. All right. That finishes up the direct acting. We have the next category, which is our thiazide diuretics. So now this is a part of the diuretic category. So there's three of them here, thiazides, loops, and then aldosterone antagonists. So thiazide diuretics, this includes hydrochlorothiazide, chlorothiazide, chlorthalidone, and metolazone. Really cool drugs. These happen to also be first line antihypertensive agents. So we have your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. We have your ACE inhibitors and your ARBs. And then we also have your thiazide diuretics. These are great first line antihypertensive agents that you want to remember. So if me and Rob had high blood pressure, we may benefit, because we don't have any other comorbidities, we may benefit from a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, a thiazide diuretic, an ACE inhibitor, or an ARB. And that's important to remember. Those are your first line agents. Now, what do these drugs really do? They help to be able to excrete sodium and water in the urine. And so that you lose a lot of that sodium and water retention factor, which reduces your preload, reduces your stroke volume, reduces your cardiac output, and reduces your blood pressure. Because of this drug and its adverse effects, one of the adverse effects is that it actually inhibits the calcium kind of like it modulates this mechanism where you actually reabsorb tons of calcium. And so it can cause hypercalcemia. And because of that, think about patients who have osteoporosis where generally their calcium levels are low and they're kind of eating away at their bone. This may be a beneficial drug to give to patients if they have underlying osteoporosis, because one of the adverse effects actually can be a benefit, which is the hypercalcemia. The other thing is, if you have a patient who's like volume overloaded, I wouldn't say this is the first line drug, but I love to do this. This is one of my favorite things, Rob. When I have a patient who's volume overloaded, they have CHF, they have a little bit of pulmonary edema, and I give them a loop diuretic like furosemide, and they pee, but they don't pee as much as I want. And so they don't actually, you know, drop as much volume out in their urine as I would prefer. They don't diurese well. What I like to do is I like to augment their diuresis. And so what I'll do is I'll give them a thiazide diuretic like metolazone or chlorothiazide or something of that nature. And I'll give it a couple, like 30 minutes before they get their loop diuretic, and it'll shut off the sodium chloride transporters in the distal convoluted tubule. And so then what happens is when you give them the Lasix or the furosemide, it blocks the sodium chloride to potassium transporter in the ascending limb. And so then you cause them to just massively diurese lots of sodium and water. And it's a really good drug to augment that volume loss in patients who are really, really volume overloaded, especially CHF patients. So I really prefer those drugs in that situation. But because they do cause you to lose sodium and because they do cause you to lose potassium in your urine, you want to watch out for hyponatremia. You want to watch out for hypokalemia. It also really weirdly inhibits uric acid excretion in the proximal convoluted tubule. So it can cause hyperuricemia. So I probably stay away from this in patients who have gout, because you're going to just make that big toe a lot worse. The other thing is that it's actually been shown to play a role within kind of reducing insulin production. Weird mechanism. I'm not going to go through it, but it actually may reduce insulin production. And so because of that, it actually can cause hyperglycemia. The other thing is that it actually can cause protons to be excreted into the collecting duct, and that actually may cause you to lose protons in your urine, which can cause a metabolic alkalosis. So you're losing protons within the bloodstream. The next category is your loop diuretic. So this is furosemide, bumetanide, torsemide. In true reality, these are not antihypertensive agents. They're more for hypertension in a patient who is volume overloaded. Remember, these drugs are really just stripping your preload down. And so they're getting rid of blood volume. The only benefit to these is if a patient's extremely volume over, like they've been in the hospital for about a week and Rob's been giving them about 3 liters of IV fluids a day, just bolusing them back to back to back. And so they're just extremely volume overloaded. This may be a drug that if you're trying to give these patients all these medications and you're like, man, their blood pressure isn't coming down, this may be one of those drugs that actually can strip off the volume and really help to be able to reduce their preload, their stroke volume, their cardiac output, and then subsequently their blood pressure. So I think that's a good one. Also, if a patient has CHF. So if a patient's not only just volume overloaded because they've been given tons of fluids, but also they hypervolemic because they have CHF, congestive heart failure, or maybe some other kind of disease, not too common, but like cirrhosis, they may just have this very significant volume overload where giving them something like furosemide, bumetanide, torsemide may strip that volume down and really help to reduce their preload, their stroke volume, cardiac output, and blood pressure. So similar effects to thiazides. They strip down the potassium, they strip down magnesium, so watch out for that. They can inhibit, you know, uric acid excretion, so don't use this in patients with really bad big toes and gouts. They can also cause a metabolic alkalosis, and watch out, it can actually really frick up the ear too and cause ototoxicity at really high doses. So if you're giving like, you know, 200 milligrams, you know, every couple hours, you better watch out for that. The last drug category is aldosterone antagonist. So this is eplerenone, amiloride, spironolactone. These are also really good drugs. Again, not one of your first line hypertensive agents. The only true reason you would give this drugs, I'd say two indications really. One is if a patient has CHF, and it's not even the volume overload from CHF, because it only causes a very minor, and I mean really minor, sodium chloride kind of like losses in the urine. So it only reduces sodium chloride excretion minimally. So it's not a very potent diuretic, but it may help. And what has been shown with this drug is that what it's been shown to do is really reduce the mortality in patients who have congestive heart failure. It may be because inhibiting aldosterone may reduce a little bit of the sodium and water retention, and that may reduce the excessive preload, the excessive dilation of the ventricles, you know, contributing to further remodeling. But what we know is that with aldosterone antagonists, they've been shown to reduce mortality in patients with CHF. So if a patient has CHF and also has hypertension, and they're already on other medications that we've already talked about, like a beta blocker, like an ACE inhibitor, or like an ARB or a thiazide, whatever it may be, and you want to add this drug on, it may be a beneficial drug to add on. One other indication that I would consider is if a patient is persistently hypokalemic and you just can't get that potassium up. ACE inhibitors and ARBs, they are great at being able to kind of bump the potassium, but even a better one is aldosterone antagonists. They'll really help. If a patient's already on an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, an aldosterone antagonist will also be a beneficial one to be able to help if they have chronic hypokalemia. So I'd also consider that. Because of it can cause your K to bump, if you don't want a patient's K to bump, watch out for hyperkalemia as an adverse effect. And then because spironolactone is not just a aldosterone antagonist, it also blocks other androgens at other sites, it can give you the man boob. So watch out for gynecomastia with that one.
Alrighty. So don't worry. I'm still here. Now I have the wonderful job of going through every single drug and every single drug class that we just talked about. No, I'm just kidding. We'd be here for 3 hours if I did that. I am not going to review that. If you would like to, you could easily just go back, rewind and hear it over again. But I think that was a lot of information, huh?
Oh, yeah, it really was. There's a lot. I think this is a really, and I mean this, guys, I really think that, get this topic down. It is so common to see patients who have hypertension. And so because of that, you need to be able to know how to manage these patients, you know, with outpatient medications that we discussed, knowing the mechanism of how you want them to work, knowing which one's best in a particular comorbidity, and then knowing which ones are actually going to be good in patients who are pregnant, which ones are good in hypertensive emergencies, et cetera. So I think it's a really, really important thing to be able to get down and really, really know stone cold hard. But otherwise, I really hope that you guys enjoyed this podcast. I hope it made sense, and love you. Thank you. And as always, until next time.